You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sachstein.
Good afternoon and welcome to Soul to Soul. It's great to be with you on a Wednesday afternoon. You can send us your thoughts and reflections. Send us an SMS, 34519. Email us on at chaibev.com or send us a WhatsApp, 061-895-1019. We continue with our crash course in Jewish history. Last time we discussed the emergence of Islam and how Islam spread across the Middle East and had a tremendous dramatic effect on all of those countries. Islam pushed further north towards Turkey and into Central Europe, and the tide was stemmed in the great battle of 732, where Charles Martel, who was the commander of the Christian forces, finally defeated the Islamic forces at the great battle of Tours just outside Vienna. And that kept Europe Christian, although the Middle East was now Muslim. The Jews were able, as we discussed, to find an arrangement, an agreement with their Muslim hosts. And as long as the Jews were dhimmis, which are second-class citizens, which are living a life of low profile and not making any demands of the Muslim rulers and making the shuls small and insignificant, so then they were tolerated in the Muslim world. And in fact, the Jewish communities were able to survive and to develop in those countries. So as we discussed last time, the majority of the Jews were living in Babel in Babylonia. And remember, from the destruction of the first temple, which was about 1,000 years before what we're talking, before the emergence of Islam, there was a large group of Jews that, in fact, most of the Jewish community was exiled to Babylonia by Nebuchadnezzar. Although 70 years later, they rebuilt the second temple under the leadership of Ezra and Nehemiah. Some Jews returned back to Eretz Israel, but the majority of Jews still remained in Babel. And throughout the times, even as the Second Temple developed and the Jews began to thrive in the land of Israel, there was still a large community in Babylonia. But by the destruction of the Second Temple, where many Jews were exiled by the Romans and sent to different parts of the Roman Empire, and as the kingdom of Rome, the rulership, the aristocracy of Rome became Christian by the year 300, so things became far more difficult for the Jews in the land of Israel until the Byzantine Christians, which was the Eastern Orthodox Church, took over the land of Israel. And they were virulently anti-Semitic and proactively tried to convert the Jews to Christianity. And if the Jews did not convert, so they were either expelled or they were murdered, they were killed. And as a result of that, Jews couldn't remain in Eretz Israel, couldn't continue to live in the land of Israel and be practicing Jews. And therefore, most of the Jews then went to Babel. And so we're talking about the middle of the first millennium, the writings of the Gemara, the Mishnah, the Talmud. Mishnah was written already in the Eretz Israel by Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, but the Gemara was written in Babel and was completed by the year 490 in Babylonia. And so we see that the core, and both quality and quantity wise, the center, the main part of the Jewish world was in Babel, in Babylonia. It remained there. So the Jewish existence in Babylonia was a long time, was over a millennium. But by the year 800, by the beginning of the 9th century, so the Jews already began to start moving from Babel. The reason being is that the situation in Babel began, the economic situation in Babel began to decline. And as a result, the Jews looked for opportunities elsewhere. Large numbers traveled to North Africa. They settled in Morocco, in Fez. And the people of Morocco were largely, there were two main groups in Morocco at the time. There were the Berbers, who were mountain people. There were the Moors, who were there also. And both of those groups were Muslims, and they crossed from Morocco over the Iberian Peninsula into Spain and into Portugal, which is what is Portugal today. And this already started from the beginning of the 7th century and kept the people kept coming into the Iberian Peninsula, and they conquered that area, and the Jews came with them. In fact, there's evidence of Jews being in Spain already from the year 690. So the Jews were in Spain for over 800 years. The Jews who came with the Muslims to Spain, they came as equals and not as demis. The Muslims needed the Jews for the different skill set that they brought. The Jews were diplomats, the Jews were linguists, the Jews were financiers. The Jews had a large network of relatives all over the Mediterranean basin. So the Jews were a necessary part of developing the economy and building the infrastructure of this new inhabitants in Spain. The Jews, in fact, invented modern forms of communications and of financial transactions. Letters of credit were developed by Jews at that time. Checks also. We have from the Cairo Geniza that there were Jewish checks already from the 1100s, from the 12th century. Jews wrote checks. They wrote a check to a cousin, a piece of paper. They said, the man who bears this check, give him 300 dinars. So since the Jews had a network all over the Mediterranean basis, it was a reliable form of financial transaction and of payment. And so the Jews were essential to the commercial development of Spain, and they became very prominent in the society. They became a part of the governing group that ruled the Spain. There were Jewish prime ministers, and they enjoyed great success and established themselves in the new community that was developed in Spain. The Jews in Babylonia continued to leave to go to North Africa and then cross over to Spain. And that is the origin of the Sephardim, of the Sephardi world. Sephard in Hebrew is Spain. And this community now, which became quite numerous, was known as the Sephardi community and the development of Sephardim. And that was the beginning of the golden age of the Jews in Spain. For 350 years, the Jews were untouchable. They became wealthy. They had positions of power. They built ornate, magnificent synagogues, and they coexisted with great harmony with their Muslim neighbors. There was even at one time a Jewish prime minister in Spain. There was actually a tribe in the Caucasus, and that tribe was called the Khazars, and the king of that tribe wanted to follow a religion, wanted to decide what the truth was, and he looked at all three major world religions. He had a public debate. He chose Judaism, and the tribe converted to Judaism. And in fact, the book Khuzari, which was written by Rabbi Yehuda Levi, is about this tribe, the Khazars. And there was therefore a Jewish kingdom there for about 250 years. At one time, there was a Jewish king in Spain, the Jewish prime minister in Spain, and you had the Khazars who were not too far away. And they wrote, the king of the Khazars wrote a letter to the Jewish prime minister in Spain saying that you're Jewish and I'm Jewish, so we can form an alliance and let's see how we could help each other. There wasn't much that came from it, but still we nonetheless see that it was a high point for Jews in the history of the exile. Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sachstein.
So we discuss now the emergence of the Sephardi Jewish community. So the Jews are in Babel until the 9th century. From the 9th century onwards, things begin to wane in Babel. And so Jews move to North Africa, to Morocco, cross over the Iberian Peninsula. And many Jews come with the Muslims from Morocco into Spain, and they are an essential part of the community, of the society, enjoy success and prominence in Spain, and that's the beginning of the 350 years of the golden age of the Jews in Spain. At a similar time, there was another group of Jews that left Babel. They were invited by Charlemagne to France. Charlemagne promised them land, he promised them protection from the government, and so Jews came to France and to Germany. They settled in Worms, in Spires, in Mainz, and all over France. They were small in number, but nonetheless they did come. So although large numbers of Jews left Babel and ended up in Spain, smaller, much smaller numbers left Babel and ended up in France and in Germany, but nonetheless that is the beginning of the Ashkenazi Jewish world. So we we find ourselves for the first millennia primarily in Babel in Babylonia, and then there's movement to Spain, the beginning of the Sephardi world, and there's movement to France and Germany, the beginning of the Ashkenazi world. At first, the numbers were very small. It's estimated that by the year 900, there were only 5,000 to 10,000 Ashkenazim, which are Jews in France and Germany. But that that small number grew to 13 or 14 million before the First World War. The Ashkenazim, as a result of coming from a very small group, it really was all like one large family. So there's a very small DNA base, and as a result, results in a prevalence of genetic diseases amongst a small gene pool. That's why we have genetic testing, which is a good idea. It's always a very good idea to test oneself if one's a carrier of any of these genetic diseases. There's an organization called Dor Yesharim, which we highly recommend that young people have themselves tested so they know whether they're carriers or not, and whether a prospective person for them to marry would also be a carrier, and if they would have problems or not have problems. So that's the beginning of the Ashkenazi Jewish world. So it's important to note that the difference was vast between the beginnings of the Sephardi Jewish world and the Ashkenazi Jewish world. The Sephardi Jewish world, as we mentioned, the Jews were equal citizens with equal rights. They were leaders of the community. They thrived and developed in all ways. In the Ashkenazi world, however, the Jews lived at the sufferance of their Christian neighbors, and they were really only allowed to thrive in Torah and no other areas. The Sephardi Jews looked at their Muslim neighbors as equals. The Ashkenazi Jews looked at their Christian neighbors as violent, as illiterate, as mostly alcoholic. They looked at them with great disdain. And some of the attitudes to the non-Jewish world were shaped from these communities. The Ashkenazi Jewish world were led by a great man by the name of Rabbeinu Gershon. He was called Rabbeinu Gershon Or Legoila. He was the light to the exile, the great light of the exile. He had a yeshiva in Mainz on the Rhine, and it was the major yeshiva that was in Europe at the time. Rabbeinu Gershon is also famous for some social decrees that he enacted. For example, Rabbeinu Gershon said that it was prohibited to practice polygamy within the Jewish world. Up until then, polygamy was allowed, was sanctioned, but he ruled it out. From that time, from the beginning of the 12th century, the end of the 11th, beginning of the 12th century, Rabbeinu Gershom also forbade anybody to read somebody else's mail, and he made the Jews the couriers of the Middle Ages, because that time everybody read it. There was no privacy in the Middle Ages, but Rabbeinu Gershom said it was asur, and therefore on the back of letters in the Jewish community was written. The letter in the back of the letter was written the following Hebrew letters, Beis Ches Dalet Reish Gimel, which stood for Becherim de Rabbeinu Gershon. And so Jews kept that decree and did not open mail, and therefore they became the couriers, because they were the only ones trusted not to read anybody else's mail. And the final social enactment of Rabbeinu Gershon was he passed a ruling that no woman should be divorced without her consent. In other words, a divorce couldn't be forced on a woman. It could only be passed by a rabbinic court if it was accepted by and wanted by the woman. Rabbeinu Gershom suffered great tragedy in his life. His son converted to Christianity, and when his son died, he actually sat Shiva 14 days instead of 7 because his son had converted. When he died in the year 1040, Rabbeinu Gershom, he had three primary students who took over his yeshiva in Mainz. Significantly, in exactly the same year, a great soul left the world, Rabbeinu Gershom, Hashem lakach v'Hashem nasan, and Hashem gives. God takes and God gives. And God also sent down into this world a very high soul, a very holy soul, a light that would light up the Jewish world and from then on and for future generations. So year 1040, Rabbeinu Gershom dies. In year 1040, a young boy is born. 8 years later, at 8 years old, this young boy goes to the yeshiva in Mainz from Troyes, or Troyes, as we said in English, and he began to learn Torah in that yeshiva. And that young boy is known to us as Rashi. Rashi stands as the acronym for Rabbeinu Shlomo ben Yitzchaki. The Shin is for the Rashi, so Rabbeinu, the Shin is for Shlomo, the Yud is Yitzchaki. Rashi enters into the great yeshiva in Mainz in the year 1048, and he stays there for 17 years. He learns Torah for 17 years until he's 25 years old. He absorbed the entire tradition from Rabbeinu Gershom, and the entire Talmudic tradition from that went back to Bavel, Rashi received in the great yeshiva in Mainz. Rashi is certainly one of the great pillars of the Jewish world. When he returned to Troyes, he wrote his great commentaries. He wrote a commentary on the Torah, on the Chamisha Chumshei Torah, on the Chumash, and he wrote a commentary on the Talmud. And those commentaries made the study of both the Torah, the five books of Moses, and the Talmud accessible throughout the ages. And Rashi, therefore, is the great teacher of the world. Rabbanan Shel Yisrael is Rav Shlomo ben Yitzchaki, is Rashi. Every Jew prides him or herself that they can learn Chumash with a bit of Rashi. From the time Rashi wrote his commentary on the Chumash, almost no copy of the Bible was printed without his Perush. And Rashi takes the Midrashim, he takes the Gemaras, and he fills in the gaps and informs us, gives us, paints the picture of what's going on, both in the Chumash and in the Talmud. And we would be totally lost without these incredible works of genius, these commentaries of Rashi on both the Chumash and on the Talmud. Around about 80% of the Ashkenazi Jewish world traces their lineage back to Rashi. Rashi dies in the year 1105. Rashi died 30 years before the Rambam is born. The Ashkenazi Jews were very strong in Torah, and they didn't have much outside influence or interaction. Primarily, they were vintners, they were moneylenders, which is a pejorative term that was used in those days. Today, we'd call them bankers. They were involved in import and export. We see Rashi's grandson, Rabbeinu Tan, was a diamond trader, and that's how they supported themselves. But they weren't, by and large, allowed to participate in the economy or in the professions, and they were very restricted in Christian Europe. And then the Crusades come along. The Crusades brought terrible suffering to the Jewish community in Europe. The first Crusade was in the year 1096. The second Crusade was in the year 1144. The third Crusade was in the year 1187. And they totally decimated the Jewish community. In the year 1240, the King of France, Louis IX, burned all the copies of the Talmud that were in existence in France and Germany. So all the yeshivas were forced to close. And so we see the decline or the suffering of Jews in Europe already from the First Crusade, the year 1096. So it's only about 300 years that the Jews are in Europe, and it already begins to turn sour. And unfortunately, we see that is the trend throughout Jewish history, a very sad trend, that Jews are invited at first to certain places, Jews are welcomed to those places, but after about three centuries, things turn sour, and the Jews are persecuted, and the Jews are discriminated against, and the Jews are forced to leave those places. So almost there are almost no exceptions to that rule throughout the long and bitter exile of the Jewish people these past 2,000 years, and Europe is no different. So Jews began to arrive, the Ashkenazi Jews began to arrive in the 800s. By the year 1096, where the first crusade begins, so the persecution and suffering of European Jewry starts, and with the three crusades and finally with the burning of the Talmud, France, and the closing of the yeshivas by King Louis IX. The Jews therefore began to leave Central and Western Europe, and they began to go to East Germany, to Bohemia, to Austria. Eventually, most of them ended up in Poland and in Lithuania, and that's the beginning of East European Jewry. So it starts out with West European Jewry. The the Ashkenazi Jewish world. And when things start going bad, the Jews turn further east and end up heading towards Eastern Europe. As we mentioned, the Sephardim enjoyed the golden age of about 350 years. They thought they would never have to leave Spain. But the first problems emerged in the 1100s when a fundamentalist Muslim group began to take over in Spain. They were called the Almohads. The Almohads are today's equivalent of ISIS or Al-Qaeda or Hezbollah. They and Hamas, of course, they rebelled and conquered Spain. And they said that all the Muslims that ruled up until now were infidels because they allowed the Jews too many rights, and they persecuted the Jews and said that the Jews should either have to convert or leave Spain. Their reign lasted about a century, and when it ended, the Jewish community was much more subdued. It really was the beginning of the upheaval of Spanish Jewry. Also in the 1100s, the Christians tried to reconquer the Iberian Peninsula, and that would continue. That attempt to defeat the Muslims in Spain by the Christians would continue for the next 300 years. The Christians pushed across the Pyrenees from France into Spain. The northern part of Spain became Christian, and Christian monarchs always tried to push south, south, south until by the time of King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella, by 1492, they drove the Muslims out of Spain. And then the Jews were entirely in the hands of the Christians. And they carried out the expulsion of the Jews from Spain and the destruction of the Jewish community, which we'll discuss in a bit of detail in a moment. But first, let's discuss another protagonist, very powerful individual who emerges. He has a tremendous impact on the Jewish world. If we call Rashi one pillar upon which the Jewish world stands, so the other pillar that holds up the Jewish house is Rabbeinu Moshe ben Maimon, the Rambam. Again, the Rambam is the acronym for those words. Rabbeinu is Resh, Moshe is Mem, Ben is Beis, Maimon is Men, Rambam. So the Rambam, he is born in the year 1150 in Cordova in Spain. The Rambam is buried in Tiberias. On his grave is written, Mi Moshe ad Moshe lo kam ke Moshe. From Moses until Moses, nobody arose like Moses. And the Rambam, it's the ultimate compliment. It's saying that since Moshe Rabbeinu, since our great leader Moshe, until Moshe ben Maimon, there was nobody else like him, which is the greatest compliment that you could receive. The Rambam was a person who defies description. He was a person who achieved unbelievable things. He was a brain of 1 in 10 million. He was just phenomenal. When he was 15 years old, the Rambam was born in the year 1135. When he was 15 years old, in 1150, he was forced to leave Spain because the Almohads took control. His father was the Dayan of Cordova, and he obviously would not convert to Islam, and therefore he was forced to leave. The family left Spain and went to Morocco, and they hid in the caves in the Atlas Mountains in Morocco for a number of years until they moved down to until they went to Fez, and then the Almohads came south to Fez, and eventually the Rambam ended up in Egypt, just outside Cairo, in Fusta, just outside Cairo. The Rambam had a brother. His brother's name was David, and David was a merchant, a very successful merchant, and he and his brother Moshe had a deal. The deal was what's called a Yisasa Zvulun, a classic partnership between two people, in this case between brothers, like Yisasa and Zvulun were brothers. They were the two sons of Yaakov, and Yisaschar was the Talmud Chochem, was the one who studied Torah all day, was the person who was in the holy tents of learning, and Zvulun was the merchant who was out in the marketplace and out in the world making a living. And the agreement, Yisrael's Zvulun agreement, is that one person learns, and the schar, the merit, the incredible spiritual merit that a person earns from learning Torah. Every word of Torah is a mitzvah. So if a person sits and learns Torah all day, so they're generating thousands and thousands of mitzvahs every day. So the Yisrael Zvulun is that the person's merit of learning is split between that person who's learning and the one who's supporting them, and the one who's the merchant splits the profits he makes between himself and the one who's learning. So it's a partnership of both this world and the next world. They'll split financial support in this world and split spiritual merit in the next world. So that was the agreement between the Rambam and his brother David, and they had a very close relationship, and they kept this agreement going right until David died. David goes missing on a voyage. He doesn't return, which causes great anguish to his brother Moshe. And then the burden of supporting both his family and his brother's family fell on his shoulders. And that's when the Rambam became a doctor at the age 52. As we said, he was just an incredible genius, the Rambam. He studied medicine. He studied mathematics. He studied astronomy. He studied pharmacology. He understood the entire Torah. The entire Torah was in his head, like the original computer. He just had it all. He received the entire tradition. And the Rambam wrote three major works. Each one would have made him immortal on their own, and he wrote three. The first one was his classic Perush HaMishnayos, his work on the Mishnah, his commentary on the Mishnah. He wrote it in Arabic. In fact, he wrote this while they were hiding in the caves in the Atlas Mountains. Unbelievable he could achieve such a thing. He wrote the Perush HaMishnayos. It's been translated into Hebrew. It's printed in the back of most versions of the Gemara, of the Shas. Absolute classic to understand the Mishnah. So that's his first work, called the Perush HaMishnayos. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment, and we'll discuss the other two major works written by the Rambam.
You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sachstein.
So after the Rambam finished his Perush HaMishnayos, written in Arabic in order that it would be accessible to Jewish people, was the lingua franca, the spoken language of the time. The Rambam then embarked on a massive project of taking all of the laws in the Torah and summarizing them in a user-friendly way. The oral tradition, the Torah Shebaal Peh, which really is the Torah, which is our whole tradition, the way a Jew lives and the way a Jew faces life and fulfills the commandments of God, is passed down to us through the oral tradition. The Rambam took that entire oral tradition, which is the Mishnah and the Gemara, which is the Talmud. He took all of the discussions in the Talmud and he summarized the psak halacha, the final halachic decision of the Talmud. The Rambam summarized and wrote it in a new user-friendly form. He divided it into 14 different parts, and he called it the Yad HaChazaka, which is the strong hand. Yad is gematria 14, Yud is 10, and Dalet is 4. It's 14, so the Rambam had 14 parts. And in fact, if you go visit the Rambam's grave in Tiberias, which I highly recommend, next time you go to Eretz Yisrael, make sure to go up north, go visit Tiberias, go visit Sfat. In both places, they're graves of very holy people with tremendous rich Jewish history. Next time, we'll talk about the great Kabbalists that were in Sfat in our next talk. So it's well worthwhile going to visit the Arizal, Rav Yosef Karo, visit their graves, visit their shuls. And in Tiberias, visit the grave of the Rambam. It's near the center of town in the old cemetery. And one sees over there that heading towards the steps towards the grave of the Rambam, there are 14 pillars. There's seven steps on each side. There's two, and they are written on them are each of the books of the Mishnah Torah of the Yad HaChazaka. Each of these 14 sections, in which the Rambam summarized all of Jewish law, and the Rambam said that anybody who learnt his book would not have to learn any other book. He would be able to summarize every relevant halacha, that everything the Jew needs to know is in this book called the Mishnah Torah. It took the Rambam 20 years, and it's a work of immense genius. It's just absolutely unbelievable. The genius of the Rambam, he was able to summarize the whole Masorah, the whole tradition of the Jewish people, the whole oral Torah, into these 14 sections, into the Mishnah Torah. The Rambam did not write sources in his Mishnah Torah. He later came to regret that. There's a story where somebody came to visit him and said to him a particular halacha he wrote. He said to him, where did you get this halacha from? So the Rambam said, I got it from Tractate Gittin. And he opened, together they sat down and they opened Maseches Gittin. And they went through the whole Masechta together, the Rambam and this other person. They didn't find the halacha. The guy then left. The Rambam, as he left, remembered, oh, it's not in Gittin, it's in Yevamos. And he sent his messenger to call him, brought the guy back. They sat down, he showed him where it is in Yevamos. The Rambam then said that he regretted not having written down his sources, because it would have been very useful for the student who's studying, who's reading his work, who's learning his work, to be able to find, to see where the Rambam got these halachas from. So it's quite ironic that the Rambam wrote the Mishnah Torah in order to summarize all of Jewish law and minimize the need to open many, many books. You'll have everything you need in one book, in one work in front of you, but there's no book in the history of the Jewish world that has had more commentaries written on it than the Rambam's Mishnah Torah, which is one of the great ironies of history. Because the Rambam wrote, the Mishnah Torah is his psak, is his final ruling on the discussions in the Talmud. And we know, firstly, we don't know the source of where he got it from. And secondly, we don't know how he learned the sugya. So in order to fill in that gap and be able to relate how the Rambam learned the sugya, there's much written on the Rambam's Mishnah Torah. Also, we see that with all of the study of Talmud in the yeshivot today takes place, the primary commentaries that we first turn to. Firstly, we look at Rashi. We learn a piece of Gemara, and then we look at Rashi. What does Rashi say? And then we say, what does the Rambam say? Because the Rambam, we don't have his commentary on the Gemara itself. We just had his psak halacha. So we have to work out from the sugya how the Rambam must have learnt the sugya, which takes, there's a lot of scope for creativity, and it takes a lot of understanding, and therefore there's almost no yeshiva by a Rosh Yeshiva or a teacher of Gemara which doesn't quote the Rambam. And so we really can't move without Rashi and the Rambam, and they both are the great lights that continue to carry the Jewish world forward. The third classic work of the Rambam is his philosophical work called Moreh Nevuchim, which is Guide to the Perplexed. It's a Jewish book of philosophy for the Middle Ages. Basically, it's Aristotelian, very different to Reb Sadia Gaon. The first book of philosophy in the Jewish world was Emunas V'Deos by Reb Sadia Gaon. The Rambam's Moreh Nevuchim is very different to that. His approach is very different. But he deals with many of the philosophical questions of the times. And he does so from a Jewish point of view in a superb way. It's not studied so much because we're not so into philosophy in the 21st century, but nonetheless, the Moreh Nevuchim was a very important work which transformed Jewish understanding and the entire Jewish world. The Rambam, as I've mentioned, was an absolute giant. He died in the year 1204 in Egypt, and the last 14 years of his life, the Rambam practiced medicine. He, as I mentioned, after his brother died, he had to support both families, and he became the court physician of the great Saladin. Saladin was the great hero of the Muslim world. He had defeated the Crusaders. He defeated Richard the Lionhearted, and he was the caliph in Cairo. And the Rambam was his doctor. He was the doctor of Saladin and the doctor of his harem of women. The Saladin said the only doctor, the only one he trusted was the Rambam. And as a result of the relationship that the Rambam had with Saladin, he gained favor for Jews throughout the world. So, for example, after Saladin defeated Richard the Lionhearted in Jerusalem, the Jews were allowed to, the Christians had expelled the Jews from Jerusalem. The Jews were allowed to return and were allowed to live in Jerusalem once more. That's because the Rambam had convinced Saladin to allow him to do so. We also see that the Jews of Yemen were saved through the Rambam and largely through the influence that he had on Saladin. So his position as the court doctor was beneficial to the entire Jewish world. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sackstein.
So we've had a look at the emergence and development of the Sephardi Jewish world with the Jews entering into Spain, starting with the beginning of the 9th century. And at a similar time, smaller numbers of Jews going to Europe, and that was the beginning of Ashkenazi Jewry. During those times, we have two great Jewish leaders, great souls that light up the Jewish world and do so for all time. And there was Rashi, who was in France, and the Rambam, who was in Spain and ended up in Egypt. And ended up being the doctor of Saladin in Egypt for the last years. Both Rambam and Rashi don't live long life. They both lived till their mid-60s. But what they achieved is quite phenomenal and unbelievable. The levels of their genius is beyond description. From that time on, however, from the round about the death of the Rambam, which is in 1204, the situation for the Jews in Spain begins to decline. The Christians begin to reconquer the region. The Spanish church was the most conservative of all the European, of all the Catholic churches in Europe. And the Jews were forced into a situation that they never imagined would happen to them in Spain. They had to choose between being Jews and between their wealth and influence in Spain, which is a very difficult decision to make. The situation worsened in the 1300s, in the 14th century, when the Christians became stronger. And now they occupied half of the Spanish peninsula, always pushing south. The Christians put great effort into converting the Jews to Christianity. In the 1300s, large numbers did convert. In fact, we see that they did make inroads into the Jewish community as a result of this strong pressure that they exerted. And even some leaders of the Jewish world converted to Christianity. For example, there were two famous rabbis that converted to Christianity, Adna of Burgos and Joshua Halaki. They were well-known Jewish leaders that converted to Christianity. They actually became the chief debaters on behalf of Christianity. Those who converted were determined for other Jews to convert as well. And as the Christians reconquered Spain, they still needed the Jews as merchants and as diplomats. So the Jews still had prominent and conspicuous positions in society. But as a result of their prominence in society, anti-Semitism was very strong amongst Spanish Christians. And the situation is further agitated by the fact that Adna of Burgos and Joshua Halaki became bishops. So the poor average Spanish priest who could never really get there or climb the ranks to become a bishop sees these two Jews, and they saw them still as Jews, as bishops, and therefore the lower class of Christian clergy preached a very violent anti-Semitism in Spain. In 1391, there was a huge pogrom. Thousands of Jews were murdered, buildings were destroyed, thousands were forced to convert by the sword. In fact, the grandfather of the great Don Isaac Abravanel, next time we'll talk about the Abravanel, he converted to Christianity. He sent his son and daughter-in-law, the parents of Don Isaac Abravanel, from Spain to Portugal, so they could still be Jewish. But we see that there were unimaginable events that were taking place in Spain in the 14th and 15th century. The pogrom of 1391 brought a complete breakup to Spanish Jewry, and everybody wanted to hang on. Nobody wants to give up their businesses or their positions, but it could already be seen that the beginning of the end of Spanish Jewry had arrived. So please God, next time we'll look at the Spanish Inquisition and the total destruction of Spanish Jewry and how that impacted it tremendously on the entire Jewish world. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day.